Hey everybody, welcome back to the Huga Nurse Podcast. Today I am really excited. We have an exceptional guest and she is making waves in the intersections of mental health, positive psychology, and giftedness. Dr. Andrea Lean, she's a psychologist and she has over 25 years of experience and she's here to share her insight and expertise on the podcast today. She's renowned for the unparalleled ability to empower and guide gifted individuals and their families toward flourishing mental health. But not only that, she's also a coach and a speaker and a writer and a consultant and a wife. And she talks about a lot of topics related to holistic mental health, workplace wellness, parenting, and emotionally intelligent leadership. She's really authentic. She's really relatable. And I think you're really going to love to hear what she has to say on the podcast today. And not only that, she has a really hopeful outlook on life struggles. And she's really inspiring to listen to. So I want you to think about ways that you can navigate life with some resilience and wholeheartedness. And I think she'll encourage you today. We're going to delve into her journey, her work with gifted individuals, and her mission to change the trajectory of mental health for future generations. We also talk about some strategies for loneliness and social connectedness of being connected to others. We're going to talk about how to foster holistic mental health, especially in the setting of your home. So it's a fun conversation. So grab your favorite cozy blanket, maybe a cup of tea or coffee, since this is a Huga podcast, and settle in for another enriching episode of the Huga Nurse. All right, friends. Welcome back to the Huga Nurse Podcast. Today, joining me is Dr. Andrea Lean. She is a clinical psychologist and a good friend of mine, is kind of brilliant and does a lot of work around mental health, especially in specialties around children and adults now. So it's great to see you again.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah. So I want to start off by just letting you tell your story. Tell me a little bit about you.
Yeah. Well, I love using positive psychology. And one of the tools we use is around character strengths. And one of my top character strengths is love of learning. So I like to tease and my husband rolls his eyes because I spent 10 years studying a lot in my 20s. And I really did focus on both clinical and school psychology, but with a focus specifically on gifted individuals. So my passion has always been really understanding and helping gifted kids, adolescents, adults with the social, emotional, mental part of life.
Right.
So that's what I've spent most of my career doing. And now I'm sort of pivoting to doing less clinical work and more education, speaking, and coaching.
Yeah. What prompted that?
My own personal journey of healing, wanting more well-being and space, and that's precipitated by some chronic illness that started happening, I think, probably not coincidentally, from a very heavy workload and pushing myself a lot through my 20s and 30s until at some point our bodies tell us it's time to take a break. And so I listened. I probably should have listened a little earlier. But in that process for myself personally, I realized that as much as I was practicing a lot of the things that I taught, when it came to rest and balance, the kind of work I was doing with the clinical population that I was serving at the time was, it was near impossible to find that balance. Mm-hmm. And so it was hard to make that shift because what I used to do was really fulfilling. And I used to tell people all the time, and it was true, that it was my dream job.
Right.
But even though it was a dream job career-wise, it wasn't a dream in my personal life.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of what I'm so passionate about now, having walked out even more so, my own physical healing. I dove into holistic healing, functional medicine as a result of that. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I bring so much more to the work that I do and the education that I do now around mental health because I have a very, I think, a more comprehensive and a different approach to it than what I was trained in. And I so appreciate all the training I got. I went to an excellent program, had amazing professors at the University of Virginia, except that it was a pretty traditionally taught program. Right. So what we learned in the early 2000s and what we know now about what contributes to mental health, there's a lot that has changed.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. We know a lot more. So I'm passionate about sharing that with other people.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, and I think it's really interesting while you were talking, I was reflecting even on my own personal journey, my professional journey, on how sometimes when you're at the peak of what you think is the peak of your career, that actually can also be the peak of your burnout.
Yes.
And what people see on the surface may not actually be your reality. So
that's right.
I love that you brought that up.
Yes. Yes. I think a lot of people at the time who knew my work, I left my job and at the very end of 2019, really about 10 weeks before the pandemic hit. It was good timing, unbeknownst to me. But a lot of people at the time said, how could you be leaving right now? Sort of, you're like at the peak. Mm-hmm. You're doing what you love. You're so good at it. How could you be leaving? And it was hard, but not hard to explain why. And interestingly, most women, I worked with a lot of families who both parents were highly educated, very influential and successful in their careers. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these working women came to me personally and said, we're so sad to see you go, but I love what you are doing because you are actually modeling for all of us, our kids, for us, our families, what it really means to take care of yourself and not, I thought of myself as like the savior, you know, but I think as therapists too, it's easy to fall into that trap, especially when you're working with high need populations, which I was. So it wasn't a conscious thought, but I think part of my struggle leaving was because I thought, well, if I leave, what will happen? Exactly, what will happen? But you know, we can leave. Mm-hmm. We can leave, and you know, even though the world did kind of fall apart 10 weeks later with the pandemic, I don't think it was because I left my job. So you know, and actually, I was so. I felt so torn in that phase, you know, that 2020, when I was just coming out, just really beginning to heal my own burnout. And I had so many people saying, oh my goodness, now everyone, you know, especially young people, and that was the population I was serving at the time, they need you. They need people like you. You have so much to offer. And I had a lot of sort of pulling on my heartstrings, not that they were meaning to do that, but a little bit of that pulling on the heartstrings. And the old me felt tempted a little bit to jump in and, like, you know, quote unquote, save the day.
Right.
But actually that me at the time, I just couldn't.
Yeah.
I couldn't. I didn't have an ounce of energy left to do that.
Yeah.
And so I took 2020, really the all of 2020 into 2021, focusing on my own well-being. And I had the lovely support of my husband to do that and focus on that. And so it's really just been the last few years. I've still been sort of walking out some of that health journey. The burnout had been dealt with, but there was still some other issues in my body. And coming into this year, I felt finally a different level of energy and kind of permission for myself to pursue the things that I want to do, but in a much more balanced way, which I'm really happy about.
Oh, I love that. Thank you for sharing that. I know today we're going to be talking a little bit about loneliness and mental health, and it's a timely topic. We had talked about the fact that we wanted to talk about this several weeks ago, but then, of course, the news just rolled out their social media reports, and, of course, the Surgeon General has released his advisory recommendations. Mm-hmm. And so I was hoping that maybe today we could talk a little bit about loneliness. As it has become very pervasive in our culture.
Yes.
And I think that I would love to hear some of your thoughts about that, maybe just in general context, how you feel about, you know, and even, you know, women, burnout, you feel very lonely in that space too. So it's not just social media. I think there are multiple things that are causing our feelings of loneliness and social isolation. So, yeah, I'd just love to hear your thoughts about that.
Yes, it is a very timely topic. And when the U.S. Surgeon General put out that advisory report last year, the stats, I don't know if they've changed much as of this moment in 2024, but at the time they reported that one in two adults reported feeling lonely.
Yeah.
And that is a huge that's half of all of us. Yeah. And I wanted to just make the distinction between the definition of loneliness versus social isolation. Yeah. So both are important, right, and both we need to address. But right, the loneliness is actually a subjective feeling.
Right.
So it doesn't necessarily mean that you're socially isolated, though you could very well be.
Right.
You could be surrounded, and I'm sure know many of people who might admit to this, you know, in private conversations, that they might have or look like they have a lot of friends or even mm-hmm. community and family around them. And yet the feeling they have is that they're alone, mm-hmm. that they're lonely. So it's not necessarily related to the number of people you have in your life. And on the other hand, I know plenty of people who might not have a ton of close relationships in their life, but they feel very fulfilled and they feel very connected. And it's not like they've got, you know, thousands of followers on social media.
Right.
It has nothing to do with that. So I think in my experience, and I think most therapists, or really anyone who's been in the mental health field for any significant period of time, we've known for a long time that issues of disconnection, loneliness, isolation, it has been pervasive, and we've seen growing. I certainly have seen it. I've been working in this field for over 25 years. It, especially working with young people, adolescents and young adults, I've mm-hmm. definitely saw a shift in my work with them in, I would say, the late, probably like 2010 to 2020, things started to really shift, and we started seeing not only higher rates, but the types of issues that were presenting at sort of the more severe range started to shift. And I know we talk a lot about social media, so I don't want to only talk about social right. media, but I do think for young adults, that's something that has been a big factor and a different thing that we've all had to sort of navigate together without knowing much going into it.
That's true.
I'm a parent, and my daughter, who's now in her late 20s, she was the generation, and so as a parent, I was the generation where they were the first ones to have access to right. things like Instagram, and we didn't really know, well, what do we do with that? You know, smartphones didn't exist when she was little, but they came on the scene when she was maybe middle school, you know, going right. into the teen years. So we had no research. We had no books.
Right.
We had no articles.
No guidance.
We were like the guinea pigs. And yeah. it was interesting because I was working as a therapist at the time with adolescents and college, you know, age students. And I had to use, I felt like I had to rely on my clinical training and what I knew about humans.
Hmm.
Not necessarily research, because we didn't have it, mm-hmm. but just what I knew about human behavior, development, adolescent development, right. child development, right? And so I made my decisions as a parent and as a clinician through that lens. And what I think is interesting now with the latest report, you know, U.S. Surgeon General recommending that there be a warning label mm-hmm. on social media specifically for adolescents. My point in all this is that this has been brewing for a long time. This is not a new issue at all, but I am happy that he is bringing it to light, and yeah. he is really in his role sounding the alarm for America to say, we all need to wake up to this. There are public health, lots of public health issues,
yes.
but this is a significant one. And depression, in my research, depression is actually, which is, I think, a lot of the time not always related to the loneliness factor, but I just want to highlight it, is one of the most, if not the most, has the most significant effect financially on our country from a cost in terms of work lost, the cost of the health insurance, you know, health mm-hmm. costs surrounded that. I think it's sad and also fascinating that this is really the main issue that we are struggling with. Suicide is the second leading cause for 10 to 14 year olds. I mean, these numbers didn't exist when I started in the field. And right. so loneliness to me is connected to a lot of that. And I think that as a culture, social media, smartphones aside, we have lost the art of connection.
Mm.
We've somehow lost how to teach it in schools, in our homes, with one another, in our churches, in our workplaces. I think there's just there's a lot of reasons for that, but I think that at the heart of it, we've sort of lost prioritizing it in any meaningful way. And here we are.
Yeah. Talk about that a little bit when you're talking about prioritizing connection. So what does that look like?
I think most people would agree in our country, we prioritize things related to achievement. Mm. We prioritize success and money. We live in a capitalistic society. And I'm not here to make a judgment call either way on that. Mm-hmm. Everyone can have their own judgment call on that. Mm-hmm. It's just that's our culture. Mm-hmm. We prioritize our kids doing well in school, right? Which I certainly wanted my child to do well in school because we know that in our society what that means down the road for them. We prioritize them getting involved in sports, which is a great thing. There's lots of things we prioritize. We prioritize our careers. But some people do. But I would say most people don't intentionally prioritize their social connections or even their connection to themselves, which I also think feeds into a feeling of loneliness. Mm-hmm. Is not just connection to other people or being disconnected, but actually a deeper disconnect from our own self.
Right.
And I don't think we talk very much about that at all.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point. And, you know, one of the strategies digging out of burnout that I remember having to do was reconnecting to myself because I also fell into the trap of success. Mm-hmm. And the question became, well, what do I do with 5 minutes of my time alone? I'm feeling distracted. I don't feel like, you know, I couldn't connect with myself.
Yes.
And so I think that might be where you're going with that sort of feeling of who am I? What do I value? How do I want to show up in the world? So, yeah, I'd love for you to maybe even expound on that a little bit.
Yeah, I think one of the things I like to say, because I truly believe it, is that we must feel like we belong in order to be well. We have to belong to be well. Mm-hmm. That's something I really, really strongly believe. It was really integral in the work that I used to do in a community-based setting. It was a therapeutic community. So everything we did was really through the lens of relationship and healing through that. And it is hard. I think it's reciprocal also that in our healing and connection with ourselves, as you started to figure out, when we burnout helps us, if we want to put it through that frame, burnout necessitates at some point that we stop, that we have to stop, right? That's what happened to me. That's what happened to you. It's happened to so many women and men. But we stop because our bodies are telling us we absolutely have to.
Right.
But our minds feel so uncomfortable with it.
Yes.
It's so uncomfortable.
It's very
especially
uncomfortable.
For us, you know, raise your hand, high-achieving, goal-driven women, all the degrees, wanting to be the perfect mom, all the stuff.
Yeah.
And so we don't like, our minds are, they have been trained our entire life to be on the go, to be going. And so when we have to stop, it's very uncomfortable. But I think in order to connect with not just ourselves, but actually to connect well with others, we have to connect with ourselves.
Right.
And then when we connect well with ourselves, we connect well with others. But it goes both ways because I would say if you took someone who wasn't connected to themselves and they were experiencing loneliness and feeling disconnected from others, I would not advise that person necessarily to sit in a room by themselves and meditate and journal and do all the things and just go inward and be with themselves to get connected. I do think that there is a place to do that. Mm-hmm. But if you stay there and that's all you do, we're built relationally. We are wired for relationship from the moment we are born into this world and we gaze up to our primary caregiver's eyes, right? Whoever that might be, we are wired to connect. And so trying to get reconnected in isolation doesn't really work well. I think that I love that more people are journaling and meditating and doing all the things and getting quiet and getting alone. I do all those things. I love it. I'm a big proponent. So hear me out. I think that you have to balance that with the intention of how do I intentionally connect on a deeper level in a way that feels safe mm-hmm. for me, because everyone comes into connection with past experiences, good and bad. Some people have more trauma than others, relational trauma. I certainly have that story in my own life, so I understand, but we don't get better unless we take those steps right. to connect. So I really do believe, even if it's starting off in a really safe container with a therapist, mm-hmm. a lot of people start there, but all the therapists might get upset by this. But I used to tell my clinical team the same thing. I said, don't think too highly of yourself. And I included myself in that, meaning the most important healing that would happen in a therapeutic community, and I believe in the world, mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily happen between an individual and an individual therapist mm-hmm. in the individual therapy room. Again, there's a time and place. I'm all for it. Mm-hmm. But even better is when you connect with another person who is a peer who gets you, and you go deep and you feel in a way that you don't feel because of the dynamic with a therapist or whoever, mm-hmm. a spiritual mentor, whoever. It's mm-hmm. different. Mm-hmm. But when you are with someone and it's mutual and you see yourself in them and they in you, a different kind of sense of belonging happens that you just can't get in the individual therapy room. So yes. I'm a huge component of either finding a safe community in the world, whether that's at your church, some sort of spiritual safe, even AA. I often will tell people, even if you don't have a problem with substances, if you want to be in a place where you can practice this in a community setting, go to something like that.
Oh, that's brilliant.
You know, yeah. it's free. Mm-hmm. They're all over. Mm-hmm.
And they're not usually supportive.
And they're usually supportive. It's not perfect because it's yeah. with people. It's just like churches. It's yeah. not perfect. We're not right. talking about perfect people and perfect circumstances, but it's somewhere you can be intentional and go and find other people who are being intentional mm-hmm. on their personal development journey, their healing journey. And it's accessible. Mm-hmm. So find a place. Maybe you have a friend group. Maybe there's a small group somewhere. But you got to take whatever you're learning. If you see an individual therapist, awesome, but take what you're learning and practice it in the real world, because it will feel different. And mm-hmm. it's in that, I think I'd be so curious if you have your own stories, but I've certainly in my own life had so much healing come from my real relationships, yeah. trusting relationships, mm-hmm. safe relationships, but those are the relationships, not necessarily the ones, although certainly including them, with a therapist or mm-hmm. a spiritual mentor of some sort. That has been really powerful for me. But I guess I'm saying use all the places, but don't neglect the power of community mm-hmm. wherever you can find it.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful. I actually mentally have images of very deep conversations I've had with very close friends and how impactful those were. Almost like a well, almost yes. like you go deep inside of a well and yes. you know that that's safe and it's not coming out of that well. And
that's right.
There's a beauty in that. And I was also thinking about, you know, there's so much research on blue zones. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about blue zones and what are one of the pillars of a blue zone, but connection with community,
yep.
feeling purpose,
yes.
feeling value. So
yes.
even the science behind that.
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up because it's so important. More people, we are talking about it. And again, I love that. Not that we have a loneliness epidemic, but I love that it's on our radar right. or it's starting to become on people's radar, you know, that we're having conversations in major news outlets and, you know, articles and books. So that's wonderful. But I think that people can start to become aware and then they think, okay, so now what do I do?
Right.
Like, what do we do? and one of the, I developed a framework based both on like all of my clinical experience in the past, the science, blue zone science, positive psychology, because right. I integrate a lot of different things in holistically. And one of my pillars, I have sort of an 8-step framework that I use, but one of the key pillars is, I call it reconnect. Mm-hmm. So usually at some point we've had some kind of connection. It's not like we don't know how to connect at all. Most of us, we grow up, we have some good experiences. Again, everyone's a little different, but we have some idea of what that means, but mm-hmm. we get busy. We just get busy in life. And like I said, it's unless we're very intentional, it can often fall to the bottom of the list in terms of how we're living our life. If I will challenge anyone listening to this right now, look at your calendar for the last 2 weeks. Add up all the hours, like how much time did I spend at work? How much time, you know, and then think, how much time did I spend really connecting with my spouse, myself, my kids, my friends, with God, if you're a spiritual person or whatever you, however you think of that connecting, like just really look at your calendar and it will tell you the story right now of what you're prioritizing. And it's not to make you feel bad. It's just like, it's like stepping on a scale. And unless you know what data point you're working with, how do you know
what to change?
What to change? So that's a great way, really easy, to just to look. And I think we all should do that periodically. I try to.
Yeah. And there's a lot of evidence, if I remember the report, the U.S. General, Surgeon General's report, I think that there's a lot of evidence that globally we have significantly decreased our time of connection with people that we care about.
Yes. Yes. Actually, I have some of the stats. The national trends, this is again for the United States. This isn't, I don't know if this is in his report, but one of the stats I pulled from 2003 to 2020. So this is not even including the last 4 years, pandemic, post-pandemic, whatever we want to call it. The time spent alone increased, while time spent on in-person social engagement decreased. And social isolation itself, measured, increased 24 hours per month. And social engagement with friends decreased 20 hours a month.
Wow.
From 2003 to 2020. I mean, 20 hours a month. That's a lot of connection that we're not, there were a lot of other stats. I'm not sharing those right now, but just that alone, it's kind of heartbreaking. And I think when we, I have a heart for everyone's well-being, but I really look at the next generation and their struggles. And I think, how can we help them if we don't even know how to help ourselves?
Yeah.
Or maybe we do know, but we're just not doing it. How do we can't ask, we can't want something for them that we don't claim for ourselves. We have to claim it for ourselves. We have to. We have to do whatever it takes. If we really want to help this next generation, we have to show them what it looks like to be a healthy, happy, connected adult. And when they have more people in their life, including their mamas, and I love moms because I was, you know, a working mom, single mom for a long time. I know how hard that is.
Yeah.
So it's not that, again, to like put another, like, oh, another thing on the to-do list of it to connect with people. But, I mean, I would love to hear your own personal story on this. I feel like for me, even when I was at the busiest, busiest burnt out space, if I had an hour with a friend over a cup of coffee, and it was few and far between at that stage of my life, at that in that chapter. Now I have lots of coffees with friends, but at, back then I did not. But if I had one, it would fill me up, and I could like go through the next week or two on that.
Yeah.
It's huge. So it feels like, oh, it's another thing, but actually it's so wonderful when we allow ourselves to just have that gift. And we're giving a gift to someone else.
Yeah.
So.
I love that. And I have so many stories. I'm a big proponent of finding time for coffee.
Yes.
Now. I didn't used to do that. Hence the word Hugo.
Yes.
But I.
Cozy coffee time.
Cozy coffee time.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is about connection. And and to your point, though, I you know, in my clinical practice, I still see patients. A lot of my patients are older adults, and I have found that, and this has been true, I've been in doing work in healthcare for 20 years, that many times my role as a clinician is just to listen, that the need for connection is so strong. Yes. We'll spend 5 minutes adjusting something. I'll spend the rest of that time just listening and just being an ear. And in many cases, the patients will feel much better after the interaction, even though I didn't necessarily do anything.
That's right.
And I have found, though, that I feel much better.
Yeah.
Just to sit there and be with them. And that's part of the reason I think that I didn't want to let my clinical practice go, even though I do research, because there's a bi-directional benefit to just connecting.
100%.
Yeah.
It's like we're parched little plants.
We are.
And then we sit with someone, mm-hmm. right? And we don't even try, we don't fix anything.
No.
We just sit
with
them.
We just sit there.
That's what I mean. We are wired for it. We are wired. So it's like having a glass of water. And then you leave and you're like, wow, I feel so much better. And even that, I think that's such a wonderful gauge for us. Notice how you feel after you're with someone, mm-hmm. even whether it's a patient that you've listened to or even a friend who you've mm-hmm. listened to, where you've done nothing necessarily. I know, again, back then when those moments were very few and far between for me, I felt like the difference in how I felt was really dramatic in mm-hmm. some ways. And to me, looking back on it now, it was just an indication of how impoverished I was in that sense.
Right, right.
It was just, I've never used this phrase before, but it was really like a poverty of connection. Mm-hmm. Even though, I will say, and I was doing all the clinical work and I was connecting with students and my staff and mm-hmm. all the parents mm-hmm. all day, every day. But I was, even in that sense, working. It did fill me up in many ways. Mm-hmm. I did. I loved the work. It mm-hmm. filled me up. But it was still different than sitting with a friend mm-hmm. or someone different, mm-hmm. right?
It's different.
Because in your career and in the professional space, there should be. There are often, especially in clinical
work,
right? There's boundaries. And yeah. so it feels different. But I hear what you're saying. Like, it's the experience of being with someone, mm-hmm. Which I actually now want to segue, just thinking about our conversation right now. We are doing an in-person interview.
Yeah.
It feels really different.
It
I just
does.
Want to bring it into the moment because we were going to do it on Zoom last week. I do a lot of podcasts, as I know you do, through the computer, which is great. It's convenient. There's just, I love in-person. I'm such an in-person. I don't apologize for it. I'm like, give me in-person stuff all the time, because as much as I love what technology can do for mm-hmm. us, I love that I can work with clients all over mm-hmm. the world, you know? But there is nothing that really beats the feeling energetically mm-hmm. and what's happening when you're in person.
Yeah. So, I agree.
Huge proponent.
Yeah. Our energies are different.
Very.
Yeah. Very good point.
Yes.
Speaking of, mm-hmm. so a lot of people spend a lot of time in their own homes.
Yes.
Part of the reason I started my business was because I've been in a lot of homes, mm-hmm. a lot of homes, probably thousands of homes. And I have found that you can either be very intentional with your space, which mm-hmm. then helps to bring connection in addition to other healthy practices. But you can also be very unintentional with your home, for lack of a better word, or even maybe there's some mental health things that are contributing, and your space can feel very anxiety provoking mm-hmm. or even perpetuate isolation, which then can potentially influence that loss of connection. So, you know, we had talked a little bit about this before, but, you know, even the dining room table, or mm-hmm. maybe you don't have a dining room, maybe the mm-hmm. the act of sitting together, mm-hmm. maybe we should call it that instead of the dining room table, is something that we tend to overlook. Maybe could you just speak a little bit to, you know, connection in the context of your home and ways that you could think about even perpetuating that inside of your own home spaces or with your own families?
Yes. I'm so excited to talk about this topic, actually. As someone who, I will say, if I didn't take the path of psychologist, I would have probably taken a path of interior design, because I love designing spaces. So it's just a fun hobby for me.
Yeah.
But I also want to give some context before I answer.
Uh-huh.
When I started my work back in 2007 is when I really got into this, although I had worked in residential treatment centers prior to that. But in 2007, I sort of just did the deep dive right out of my graduate training in therapeutic communities. And I learned so much from some mentors at that time around what we refer to, as clinicians refer to, as milieu therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And it is rooted in the idea that our environment, our surroundings, influence highly mm-hmm. our emotional and our behavioral well-being.
Yeah.
So what I would try to explain to people, even the families that would come enroll their kids in our school, and they'd say, oh, well, how much therapy is there? Meaning, how often will my child get individual therapy?
Oh, okay.
And I would try to explain to them that in addition to individual therapy, we also had lots of group therapy all through the week, but there's this concept of milieu therapy, which is every aspect of the environment is intentionally shaped to support healing and well-being. Mm-hmm. So I could nerd out on that concept all day, but I want to take that, like that background that I have that we used in therapeutic spaces. Mm-hmm. It made so much intuitive sense to me. And I thought, why didn't I learn more about this in my training? And I think other training programs may emphasize that more or less, but mm-hmm. I really didn't learn much about it until I was doing that work in the setting. And I even remember at some point we were thinking about buying a different building. And so I was with this team going all around the state. We were looking at other buildings to buy. And we all kept saying, well, this wouldn't work. And we were talking about like the layout because it makes a huge difference, mm-hmm. a huge difference. And so the place that the school was in actually was a castle. So it had an actual castle built in the late 1800s, but it had this beautiful communal open, huge, you know, lofty ceilings, and it was very grand and beautiful. But when I talked to the person who started this program back in the 80s, he said, I wanted to create a space. And this actually was very true in the past, like in the 40s and 50s, mm-hmm. 60s, when this idea of like a mental hospital was was in vogue back mm-hmm. then. We don't really have that in the same way today. But they weren't these like awful, you know, like hospital sterile settings. They were these beautiful, everyone had windows, they were overlooking nature.
Right.
Every aspect was designed to support someone's healing and their mm-hmm. well-being, which I think is brilliant. I don't know exactly why we don't do that in the same way today. Most treatment centers that I have seen don't capitalize on the beauty and aesthetics of the space, not just the safety part.
Right.
Most of them think about that.
Right.
But they don't really think about how do we use color and light and the right. architecture of the space, the furniture, the layout, the flow between rooms. How do we do that to support connection, well-being, healing? So as it relates to our homes, mm-hmm. I think you can use all these concepts, right? Some of the things we can't change. Like when I was first starting out, I lived in a little basement apartment
right.
with like two windows, right. you know, and it wasn't particularly beautiful. But I remember even through my graduate training, I had zero money. I did get a different house after that with more windows. So we weren't in the basement for long. But, you know, I tried in every place to make it, even on a shoestring budget,
yeah.
Cozy. And beautiful in the sense that of what that meant for me,
right.
and meaningful and welcoming for people to come in. So
right.
I think it's not a matter of how much money you have. Mm-hmm. I have seen people with tons of money and their homes don't feel necessarily cozy, personal, or inviting.
Right.
And I've seen people with very little money who have the most beautiful, inviting personal home. So I want to just encourage people. I think a lot of times we might feel like, well, I need like this huge budget to like redo my whole house because we're, you know, looking on Instagram and we think our kitchen has to look a certain way, our living room has to look a certain way. But I think a very practical way is think about your space right now in your house. How many spaces are intentionally designed for personal connection with one another versus looking at a screen?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
A lot of houses. And again, I'm not saying this to judge anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I have friends. They've got younger kids. They've got a big screen in the because that's the phase of life they're in. My daughter has grown up out of the house. But we, even when she was little, we never had a TV as the central part of our home because that was just, for me, a personal decision. There were never TVs in rooms. When I ran the school, kids didn't have access to screens in their bedroom. So there are like, whether it's a TV screen, a laptop screen, an iPad, you get to decide as the adult in your home the structure of it. Mm-hmm. Think of it as like, this is my therapeutic milieu. How do I'm the clinical director of my own home. How do I set it up so that we connect as a family over a meal? Again, maybe you don't have a dining room, but maybe you do have a dining room and you're not using it. So that article in The Atlantic was all about the invisible dining room, or like the diminishing of the dining room in the American home. They're not even designing places anymore with dining rooms, mm-hmm. because people are sitting in front of the TV and eating their meal. I think that is a really easy first step, is just think about the house. Think about the rooms. Are there spaces that invite people to come together? How is the furniture placed? Are there chairs? Or is it just like a huge screen that takes up the whole space, right? And again, I'm not just talking about screens, but that is usually the predominant. And then that sends a message. It sends a message to everyone in your house and anyone that comes into your house that we come in and we're just going to be entertained by something on a screen versus sitting down and being intentional. And so you might be in a place where you're like, well, I have kids. Of course, we're going to have a screen. Like, fine. That's fine. Again, just make... That's your choice. Mm-hmm. Can you find another space in the home that is like a little sacred space, that is a place where people could connect? Maybe it is just the dining room and you clear off the dining room so you can actually use it. Mm-hmm. One thing I love about my husband's parents, and I learned this about them early on, I thought it was so sweet. Even when they're kids, they have two kids, obviously grown now, but when they were little, all growing up, it didn't matter the day. It wasn't a special event. Every night, not only did they sit down together for dinner at the dinner table, but they lit candles. And I just thought, even if you are eating on paper plates that night because mm-hmm. it's been a full day and you're just mm-hmm. got takeout pizza, right? Whatever the day has mm-hmm. been. There was just something about this idea of like, and my sister actually does this too at mm-hmm. her. She's got four kids.
Yeah.
Where you like, she puts on some soft music to like set the atmosphere. So you can use music, right? It's not just the physical space.
That's right.
You use lighting intentionally, right? We have softer lighting, not glaring overhead lighting. It kind of feels more intimate. And she'd light candles, right? Like something as simple as that. You don't have to have a crazy four-course meal to invite connection over the dining room table. Mm-hmm. It's just about intentionality.
Yeah, I actually do that occasionally. And so much now that my youngest son will be like, are we going to light the candles tonight?
See, because kids intuitively know it feels special and mm-hmm. different. And even if we think about ourselves, like if we go to a really nice restaurant, like a special date night, and it feels different when it's like there's a romantic atmosphere and there's candles and it feels softer. So like take whatever, everyone has different design, you know, it's like a personality. Everyone mm-hmm. has a different personality. Your taste won't match my taste. You might come into my house and say like, I would not choose these colors. Fine. Mm-hmm. Everyone's different. But like take what you notice when you're out in the world and you're like, this is inviting or this feels calming. I often, again, it's like a side hobby, like passion, a project of mine. So if I have friends or family members who are wanting to redesign their house, mm-hmm. they'll just call me up and I'll make a mood board for them. And then I'll come into their house and design the space. Oh yeah.
I've done it all.
It's so fun. I love it. I love it so much, but I will go in. It's like, I use my psychologist brain to like create the space that they love.
Yeah.
And I don't advertise that. I'm a little nervous saying it now on a podcast, but no, if you're interested, you know, DM
call
me.
Call this.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I do love to do it, but I would start always with asking the question, well, what is it that you want to feel when you walk into your home? Mm-hmm. How do you mm-hmm. want to feel? Because that's actually what we're really trying to get at. Mm-hmm. And usually I had a dear friend from high school who I helped her a few years ago. Now she has like her dream home. She literally thought she was going to have to buy a different house. And her husband was not happy. So I like to say, take some credit, Kate and Tom, for saving their marriage, saving their in the same house. They did do some renovations, but like she was able to realize that she felt, you know, she's a busy working mom. Mm-hmm. She has a very intense, really wonderful, amazing job, but it was a lot. So she'd come home and there was the clutter of the toys and there was this and that. And the dining room table had stuff on it. And she didn't like the color of the walls and she felt anxious. Mm-hmm. And she's like, I just want to come into my house and feel like I'm on vacation.
Yeah.
And so we took that idea and then we created the mood board. And then step by step, she they repainted the walls and they did this and they cleared up the clutter. They made an organized area for the boys to have a playroom. And those things made such a difference. She's like, I can't believe it. I love this home.
Yeah. It makes a huge difference.
Yes. But I think asking that question, how do you want to feel?
Yeah.
And there's a lot around, you know, color psychology mm-hmm. and all the things. But mm-hmm. I think decluttering is a huge one. Mm-hmm. Decluttering is a huge one. That alone helps decrease the cortisol levels, yes. increase well-being.
I'm so glad you said that out loud.
Yes.
Because I've been harping on that. And
yes.
It's really an easy thing to do. It's, well, I will acknowledge, and I think I did this even in my little course, my little mini course, that there are underlying reasons that we hold on to things.
Yes.
And it's usually not because you need it.
That's right.
So I acknowledge that. But it's also something that's pretty accessible that you can do to help your home feel a little bit more homey.
Yeah. And I was thinking about this before the podcast. I thought, I want to be really careful because I know that a lot of women, especially moms with younger children or older children, just any children, mm-hmm. and the dogs and the cats and the everything, right? There can be a lot of shame and guilt. And I think that's one of the things that can stand in the way of having people over and connecting, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, we think our homes have to be totally decluttered and clean and perfect in every way, because again, we see these pictures on Instagram. So I want to have this balance of recognizing that decluttering will help mm-hmm. for sure mm-hmm. for yourself and your family. And I think for the experience of guests coming in to mm-hmm. feel like it's a little more inviting to not have tons of stuff everywhere. On the other hand, mm-hmm. don't let it become the obstacle for having people over, because especially if you're a mom and you got mom friends, everyone gets it. Everyone, and people come to my home now. I have no small children living in my home.
Exactly.
And they're like, oh, your home is so beautiful. And oh, it's so peaceful and this and that. And I think, well, yeah, I don't have toddlers running around.
Yeah.
So don't compare your home to mine right now.
I love that.
Like, give yourself a lot of grace, depending on the stage of life. And then, you know, you have your goals, you know, you have your mm-hmm. goals. And maybe mm-hmm. it's just as simple as, I'm going to declutter my makeup drawer in the bathroom, mm-hmm. all right, for my own self. It's not even about anyone seeing it, but just for your own sanity, you're like, I'm going to pick some small little place and declutter that. And I think that from that place, you can build momentum. But I do think that feeling, we used to do this at the school too, of, you know, we encourage our students. It wasn't just about taking care and cleaning the room for the sake of like, you have to have a clean room. It was like, we knew that they would have a sense of pride. It's reflected in the space that you have, right? If my workspace, actually this is kind of true right now, my workspace, the desk, it's got stuff all over the place because I'm in the midst of project, mm-hmm. right? But if I keep it like that for too long, I start to just feel like, mm-hmm. I don't want to be in here. I don't feel inspired.
Yeah.
Your creativity goes down. Like mm-hmm. there's so many things that get affected, not just your whether you feel depressed or anxious, mm-hmm. like truly your whole mind we're influenced by our surroundings, right?
Yeah.
So it's just being aware and taking the little baby steps as you can, but don't let perfection get in the way of the connection.
I'm glad you said that. Yeah. Cause I'm all about removing the shame and the stigma of what you think should be your home reality.
And my husband, I'll be very transparent, cause if he ever heard this conversation, he would probably be laughing, because I was a perfectionist as a child. Mm. It's like a lifelong rewiring in my brain to not have perfection be the goal. So I have learned to relax. He probably thinks that's funny because my version of relaxing is like, you know,
maybe not his.
Not his. But like, if the house is a total disaster, it hasn't been cleaned for a week, and he's like, I want friends over, you know, I'm like, well, can we at least clean up a little bit? Like, can I at least, like, get the bathroom, you know, the powder room tidied up? You know, like, there are certain things that maybe just the way I was raised, like, you just do before guests come over. So there's balance, but for sure, like, I say, especially today, it's cheaper to have friends come over to your house than to go out. So
that
from
is
a
so
financial
true.
Standpoint, just bring them over.
Bring them
you know,
over.
Bring them over, have a potluck. It's so much better.
I love that. Well, This has been great.
So fun.
Oh my gosh.
So fun.
We could keep going.
We could.
But we can't. So,
no.
So I want to ask, you've brought up a lot of really good points, and I'm sure somebody's listening and being like, okay, I really want to take a journey toward, you know, connecting with others, or maybe even thinking about my home. Do you have any thoughts about resources or next steps that they could take?
Yeah. Well, there's actually there's a book. Well, maybe not specifically for your home. There's lots. I think there's a lot of great even design books there that if you go to any local bookstore, you'll find tons of fun stuff out there. And again, I have tons in my home. But there's a book that just came out this month called The Art and Science of Connection, Why Social Health is the Missing Key to Living Longer, Healthier, and Happier Lives. It just came out, so I haven't read it. Mm-hmm. I did read an article about the author and the book, so I'm excited to read it because it's sort of like top of the list, obviously, because of what I am passionate about. But I'm excited to read that. And then I think in terms of dealing with maybe the internal pieces that keep us in that place of either actual social isolation or even just the feeling of loneliness. Mm-hmm. It's an oldie but goodie, but I can't help but recommend a Brené Brown book. But Braving the Wilderness
is a good one
for that. I think it's really good just to kind of get to some more of like the heart internal issues. But I think beyond that, again, I don't think it needs to be complicated. It's just look at your home. How do you want to feel? How could you use light? How could you use furniture layout? Again, you can't change necessarily the flow of your home unless you move homes, but you don't need to move homes necessarily.
Right.
But you can just do the best with what you have. Maybe count up the number of screens you have in your home and see if you can like minimize it a little bit. Have a little place where you can put your phones or things to charge, like a hub in your home, so it's not they're not just all over.
Yeah.
Maybe bring in a little area to have a meal to, you know, facilitate the connection. I think also our bedrooms are great places. So even though I don't have specific books on that, I think that just starting easy is really good for people to begin.
I think that's a really good point. I know I'm just going to bring this up because I remember walking into our home. And our home has a formal sitting room in it. And I'm like, I am not going to use a formal sitting room. What am I? And it's the first room you see when you walk in.
That's right.
So I'm like, what am I going to do with that room?
Yes.
And I have turned it into a multifunctional room. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure how it was going to turn out. But for the purpose of connection. So we have a little round table in there. It's for it gets the most used room in the house because I was so worried that it would turn into this little library space. Nobody would use it. Yep. And, you know, people just pass by it and think, oh, that's a pretty room. So it is the most used. It's the messiest room in my house. Mm-hmm. And talk about decluttering. I'm big on decluttering, but it is also really hard to declutter.
Nice. Yeah, but it's also nice when you just have lived in spaces.
Yes.
It's real.
Yeah. Right now there's a volcano sitting on the table.
Yeah.
It needs to be erupt. Like there's like there's some chemical reactions that need to happen. So I think that there's just adding spaces like that intentionally, and you don't know what's going to happen. You just, but your family just starts to naturally navigate toward, oh, there's a table there. We can use it for our homework. Oh, there's a table there. Maybe we should do our games there or whatever.
So I love that you said that actually. And I'll just expand just for a moment on that, because I think that oftentimes in our homes, this is especially true as the house gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. And of course, in America, it's always like bigger is better, but not when it comes to connection. And without going down a bunny trail, my dissertation really got into what happens, especially in affluent homes, the larger neighborhoods, people start getting more spread out and lots of things happen from a disconnection standpoint. But if you've, say you've got multiple children and everyone's like going to their room or their different space, right? Like, and you've got a man cave and you've got the she shed and you've got the kids teen cave, like all these different spaces, which is like fun in a certain way. And I get it. And even I've liked those spaces, but then everyone's like in their own corner of the house. So having even just one multi-purpose room like that, where people can do their homework, but also play a game, but also maybe practice their guitar or whatever. Just that, like communal doing life together is great to have in your house if you can find a space for that.
Yeah.
I love that.
It's one of my favorite rooms.
Yep.
Yeah.
And your kids will always have memories of
it's
that.
It's the messiest room.
Yep. Yeah. Fine.
Well, my last most important question
yes.
is if you could be a macaroni shape, what macaroni shape would you pick?
I love this question. Oh my goodness. There's so many good shapes. I don't really know why, but I want to say a bow tie pasta.
Okay.
I don't know why. I think they're just kind of like fun and sort of like cute and different. And I want to be fun and cute and different.
Yeah,
I don't know.
They're playful.
They're playful. Yeah. Maybe that's what it is. They're just yeah. playful, right? Like who eats bow tie macaroni? I don't know. But sometimes
yeah.
I do.
Yeah. And you have to chase it around the plate.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what I'm going to say. Bow tie.
I love it. Well, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Conversation.
So fun. I love it.
Yeah. All right.
Wow. We touched on so many important topics today, from the critical role of boundaries and feedback and leadership to the pervasive issue of loneliness and the importance of connecting with other people. Andrea's insights on how we can reconnect with ourselves and others are really very timely and valuable. So remember that fostering genuine connections really can significantly improve your well-being. And I love how Andrea emphasized the concept of milieu therapy and the impact of our environment on our mental and emotional health. It's a reminder that our surroundings deeply influence our state of mind. And by making some intentional changes in our homes, we can really create spaces that support our well-being. She also shared some really great resources with us, like the book called The Art and Science of Connection, Why Social Health is the Missing Key to Living Longer and Healthier and Happy Lives. And this book will dive into the importance of social health and some practical strategies that you can use to enhance your own social connections. And then she also recommended one of my favorite books, Braving the Wilderness by Brené Brown, who is also one of my favorite people. And that book explores the journey of finding true belonging and the courage to stand alone even when it's hard. And speaking of creating supportive environments, I wanted to share something exciting with you. At Huga Abode, which is the business that I have started online, we begin to put together the power of well-organized and thoughtfully designed home concepts.
Goodbye for now.
And hopefully you'll find these digital courses helpful because they're designed to help boost your well-being through your own home. So there's a series of digital courses designed to help you declutter your home based on your personality type. And also I have a couple that are related to designing your kitchen for health and designing your bedroom for better sleep. I thought it might be helpful to have courses like this as you're thinking about how to build your own home to support your own health and your well-being. So maybe you're an organized minimalist or maybe you're a sentimental collector. Either way, the decluttering course helps guide you through the process of creating a space that feels good for you. And our courses also incorporate the principles of Huga, which ensures that your home is not only clutter-free, but it's cozy and inviting and full of joy. So anyways, I just wanted to let you know that they're out there. They're on our website, and I'll put the link to the website in our show notes. Well, I'm really excited to help you on your own journey of creating a more organized and serene home. And hopefully these podcast episodes are helping you think about your own well-being and the importance of caring for yourself. So please keep nourishing your mind, your body, and your spirit. Stay cozy and connected. And goodbye for now.